Michigan. I'm 5 years old. My brother's 4. We're headed back from church, and on the radio, they're going on about the big storm a-coming. So we head over to the IGA grocery store in Bay City to stock up. The place is frenzied. Everyone's been through this drill before. And you have to understand, normally, my parents are all crazy health food people. Black, rural, Afro-Jesus hippies. We got the shredded wheat, the pickled sandwiches on stone ground bread, molasses on celery with that oily natural peanut butter. You know all that crap. But today, Mom's starts reaching for the Captain Crunch cereal, grabbing the Toll House cookies off the shelf. Me and my brother, we can't believe it. What? Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Wonder Bread, Turkey Roll, who are these people? And when my brother and I shove something in the cart, a Little Debbie fruit pie or a box of Cosmopolitan ice cream, instead of smacking us upside the head, they just hurry to the next aisle. Pops grabs 4 Hungry Man Salisbury steak dinners with the apple pie dessert, then grabs a couple more for good measure. Yes! We can already see the snow starting to fall. Big, wet, heavy flakes. We know we don't have much time. The cold darkness, it's dropping quick. In the cashier line, behind everyone else, we throw in a couple Hershey chocolate bars for good measure. We pack up the Country Squire station wagon, wood paneling, yo, and we're out. I can tell by the look of my dad's face as we turn off the main highway to the service road, to the side road, that he's scared we are not going to make it. We don't make it. The car thuds into a snowbank about a half a mile from our house. He tries to push through, but finally, we all just wrap up and go out into the blizzard. Pops carries me in one arm and my brother in the other. Sometimes my mother carries one of us, but mostly him. The snow falls in huge bricks. He carries us all the way back to our house. We turn on the lights and the heat, and it's blazing. Pops goes back out into the cold for groceries. He has to make 2 trips, but when he gets back with the second load, even as he's putting logs into the wood stove, the power goes out. Country darkness. But we don't care. My mom, my mother, she starts passing out mugs of hot chocolate with the marshmallows. And me and my brother, we can't believe our luck. It tastes so good. I stir a chocolate bar into the cocoa and I pray to white Jesus that we can spend every night in the darkness. Well, today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Blackout. Amazing stories from real people sitting in the dark. My name is Glenn Washington. Please make sure your woodpile is properly stacked, because you're listening. Snap Judgment. Now then, our own Anna Sussman is going to kick off the Blackout episode from her home away from home, Liberia, West Africa.
The radio station where I worked used to broadcast music out onto the dirt street. Kids would dance together on the roadside. Today the station is silent, and the gate at the entrance is only open a crack. I slide through. Inside, I'm startled to see a very old man, shirtless and fast asleep on a wooden bench. I've never seen him before. He opens his eyes and looks at me, or more, through me, then closes his eyes again and falls back asleep. He's been dropped off here at Radio Basso, a tiny two-room community radio station. The windows are blown out and covered with plywood, and dusty wires hang from the ceiling. The reporters spend most of the day out on the little porch. I sneak past the old man and head out to the porch to find them. A few reporters, James, Muhammad, and Godwin, have been working here for decades. They started the station during Liberia's first civil war. When rebel groups were creeping through the country like locusts, swarming over towns and leaving nothing but carcasses of buildings and stunned widows, James, Muhammad, and Godwin built a radio tower by hand out of scrap metal and bought a little generator. Then they would broadcast information about troop movements and deadly roadblocks. Hundreds of families across the countryside would listen to the transmission, connecting them to one another in the quiet nights of war. More than once, rebels shut down the station. But then these guys would sneak out at night and fire up the generator to broadcast lifelines of information out to remote jungle towns. Then they'd sneak back home. The guys tell me the old man in the hallway was brought to the station last night. He has dementia. He doesn't know who he is, and neither does anyone else in town. We begin to just call him Old Man. Old Man smells like sweat and old skin. His feet are caked with thick cracks and dirt. As the day goes on and the open-air station gets hotter, Old Man wakes up. I ask the guys, what's the plan for Old Man? They say they don't know. Old Man goes back to sleep. I'm working at the station to train local journalists in human rights reporting. But these guys are twice my age. They've survived 14 years of civil war.
The West African country of Liberia has been cut off from the world.
15,000 peacekeeping operation soldiers were deployed.
This war resembles no
other. But what's really happening in Liberia?
Soldiers are everywhere. They're just boys.
They've lost wives and children. They've lived through more human rights abuses than most journalists have seen. Now they're sitting around in the literal ruins of their country, wondering how to rebuild. The other day, we took a motorbike down sandy, washed-out streets to the local prison. The prison itself was just an open-air courtyard with crumbling stone walls, covered with roots and moss, like something out of Tomb Raider. There, we found prisoners who'd been waiting for years for a trial. They just stayed there, sitting in the shade of the trees, all day long. It's the same story everywhere we go in town. The police say they have no guns and no working phone, so no one could even call them for help. The hospital doesn't have enough electricity to store blood. The teachers don't show up at school because they haven't been paid in months. In the beginning, we would write up the stories about the police or the schools or the hospital, but not anymore. Now the station is out of money. So they can't run the generator, so they can't broadcast a signal. For the last few weeks, we've just sat on the porch, watching the town's main street. In the late afternoon, I offer Old Man a donut and a piece of grilled corn. He snatches the food out of my hand, but then he attempts a nod of thanks with his shaky, wrinkled head. At the end of the day, when it begins to get dark, the guys have to decide what to do about Old Man. He's asleep again. They put a bottle of water next to his bench and lock him in the station for the night. Old Man stays at the station for 3 days. The reporters and I sit on the porch. Rainstorms pass through. UN trucks armed with peacekeepers roll by. They talk about the wars, hiding in the shadows of pickup trucks to find information about rebel movements for their broadcast. About how the station used to actually do something. But now there's just frustration and malaise and corruption, and the station is silent. Then James stands up, with a purpose. We stand up and follow him, past Old Man, down the stairs to the generator room. He unlocks the padlock. He grabs the heavy backup generator with both hands and rolls it from side to side, grunting in the heat. He's trying to move any last drops of gasoline to the motor. He gives the cord a pull. Nothing. He pulls, heaves, shakes, until the motor coughs to life. Then we march upstairs to the studio. He puts on headphones, flips on the switchboard, clicks on the microphone, and begins to announce the details of Old Man. He describes his clothes, his language. If you are missing your old man, your old father or husband has gone missing, we have him. Then he plays a few songs and announces the old man's description over and over, until a few minutes later, the power dies out again. We go back to the porch, and as the sun's going down, the station's getting dark, and the market vendors are lighting oil lamps, a woman comes up to the porch and says, "I'm here for my father."
Thank you, Anna Sussman, for sharing your tale. Now, I can't wait. I cannot wait. A few weeks ago, we did a Snap Live show in front of an amazing San Francisco audience. We'll have the whole thing for you soon, but I thought that on today's Blackout episode, maybe we'll give you a little sneak peek, Snappers. Snap favorite, Joshua Walters rocked a story about a blackout of a spiritual sort. Snap Judgment, live.
Now, our next storyteller, he's been here from the beginning. He has a new one-man show in Berkeley at La Peña that's going to start November 22nd. Let me get out of the way for Mr. Joshua Walters.
I used to have payas, little Jewish curls springing from my forelocks. They were fantastic and asymmetrical. Payas. Some said I looked Amish. Some said I looked goatish. But it didn't matter. I was on a spiritual quest and a religious journey. Payas! 1 year I cut off the curls and joined a Buddhist monastery. The monastery was located in the Trinity Alps, way up in the most northern reaches of Northern California. When I got there, the HLIC head lama in charge was a fat white guy with a big belly and a ponytail and greasy lips named Lama Carnivorous. When I first got there, he was having a potluck at his house where they were serving pork spare ribs. This was not the custom where I came from, so I enjoyed it even more. Lama, this is Buddhism?
Joshua, not every lama has potlucks like this. Don't get used to it.
Lama, you see that girl? What's her name?
That is the girl that made these delicious ribs.
So delicious, Lama.
Yes, Joshua.
Lama, this too is Buddhism?
Yes, Joshua.
Her name was Mia, and she drove around in a dusty old car listening to 10-year-old dance hall. She worked in the kitchen, serving up all sorts of piggish delights. I worked outside, painting the stupas, red and gold. 8 statues representing the 8 stages of the Buddha's life. I was out there every afternoon, painting away. I had the best job there. And then, Lama Carnivorous left to have triple bypass surgery. Overdose of lard. The new head lama in charge was a skinny white guy who wore tank tops and rode around on a bicycle named Lama Tofu Patty. This lama's first order of business was that there would be no more pork. Instead, we would only have 1 vegetarian lunch per day. We sat across from each other at the lunch table. Long stares over lima beans. I said to the lunch crowd, "You know, when I first got here, I saw 2 naked Buddhas getting out of the lagoon, and I thought to myself, oh, this is Buddhism." Mia laughed. Tofu Patty remained perfectly calm. The hatred was potent. The next day, I was painting up the stupas, and Lama Patty approached me and said, "You know, Joshua, you were assigned these stupas when Lama Carnivorous was here, and now that I am here, you shall now polish these brass bowls." This was quite a demotion, but I did it. Just as long as I got to have my swims every afternoon in the lagoon with Mia and a lot of large minnows. We swam one afternoon, and after we dried off, she said, "You know, that Lama Tofu Patty had approached her on his bicycle and said, 'Stay away from that, Joshua. His vision is impure.'" The next day, I was polishing those brass bowls, and Lama Tofu Patty approached me and said, "Joshua, you shall no longer polish these brass bowls. Now, you shall mop up the kitchen floor. This is the lowest job there, but I did it. Just as long as I got to have my swims every afternoon with Mia in the lagoon." And one day I was mopping up the floor, and my vision became slanted. I didn't know if I was mopping clean or dirty anymore. I couldn't really see what I was doing to the floor. And then I had to meet Mia out in the lagoon, and I ran down 15, 20 minutes late, and there she was, looking like a fantasy with a life preserver, and I had to come back to do my chores because the floor wasn't mopped, and I had to mop it all up, and I thought, this is not the way to live my life. And I put the broom down, and I went into the refrigerator, and I saw that she had left me lima beans in a little container with my name on it. But then I realized that next to it was another little container with Tofu Patty's name on it, and it had a pulled pork sandwich. Oh no.
No!
The next day, Lama Tofu Patty approached me and said, "You know, Joshua, your stupa painting, your bowl polishing, and your kitchen mopping, you know, they're not good enough. Now you will..."
"Stop right there," I said. "I see what you're doing.
Maybe I'm not meant to be here. Maybe we both need something different. I said my goodbyes to Mia and got in the car and drove all the way down to the more centrally located part of Northern California. And as I crossed over that Golden Gate Bridge, the bridge started to lick my car, and I was having a religious vision. And I looked at the sky, and a red and gold Buddha flew down from the sky, riding a pig the size of a horse. And he flew down, and he unfurled his hands, and inside his palms were two Jewish girls. Payas.
Payas!
And then the Buddhist pig looked at me and said, Joshua, when you're on a spiritual quest, stay true to yourself. And for my sake, keep it kosher.
Joshua Walters. To learn more about his world, visit thejoshuawalters.com. The original score was by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex and the Snap Judgment Players, Tim Frick and David Brand. Now, if you want to see that performance in all of its Technicolor glory, Will Urbina, our own Will, he made something special for you. It's at snapjudgment.org right now. And know this, we're going to drop the full episode of Snap Live in SF very, very soon. Stay tuned for that. When Snap Judgment continues, we've got a song that no one wants to hear. And look who's coming to dinner. When Snap Judgment, the Blackout episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap, the Blackout episode. Today, we're featuring stories where darkness falls in some very strange ways. Now, there are songs that will bring you to ecstasy, make you feel real joy. But there are songs with melodies so intense, they inspire the most melancholy of emotions. A brief warning, this next story alludes to some mature content, so sensitive kiddies may want to sit this one out. Davy Kim has a story.
I remember when I was 5, my dad was playing the piano in the next room from my bed, and I heard that beautiful melody that just touched me immediately. The next morning when I said, what was that song that you were playing yesterday? He said, you are still little one, so please don't even think about it. Forget it. When you will be adult, it will be okay, but now it's not.
That's Laszlo Marosi, a Hungarian music conductor. He's talking about a song composed by Rezo Sheresh in the early 1930s.
Rezo Sheresh was growing up in a very poor Jewish family in Hungary, but he didn't go to school to learn the piano. He himself just was sitting from the piano and with right hand started to discover the keyboard, what kind of sound is coming from what note.
There's not much known about Sheresh's early life, except that he aspired to become a famous songwriter. So he did what other aspiring songwriters did. He moved to Paris.
Paintings, arts, theater, everything. Paris was the center. He had a girlfriend with him, so he thought that the doors of life are opening for him.
In Paris, Cherish composed many songs, many of them now unheard of. He was trying to live the life of a big-time composer, but there was one problem. He was not a big-time composer.
Everyone thought, who is this amateur? He didn't really succeed in Paris. He did not succeed at all.
His girlfriend nagged him constantly, telling him to give up his dream, get a 9-to-5 job. But he wouldn't have it. Either he'd become a successful songwriter and change the world, or he'd live out on the streets.
When she saw that he didn't become famous, he didn't got the money, he didn't succeed the way how they expected. So she just said, okay, bye-bye.
And bye-bye went the love of his life. The day after their breakup, which happened to be a Sunday, Cherish found himself alone in his apartment. Like the many fruitless times before, he started tapping away at the piano, trying to capture the emotions from the fresh breakup.
And that moment in that gloomy afternoon on that Sunday, a sad and mysterious melody started to appear in the mind of Cherish.
Inspired by the melody, his poet friend helped him write the lyrics. They would call the song Somuru Vasharna, or Gloomy Sunday.
The beginning of the song, a beautiful, inviting, dark sound with those ascending arpeggio of a minor chord.
Somuru Vasharna Sahir Virago Varasala
All together, the melody, the phrasings, the text that he uses there to describe his pain and his sadness is just so lovely. And it's a very sympathetic way stated everything, no complaining, still offering the love. I know that you left me, I know this all, but please know that I love you forever and my love can't be stopped even if I am dead. Don't close my eyes because my love will still go through my dead eyes. Beautiful.
Cherish went to many different publishers to try to get his song recorded. They all turned him down, saying that his song was just too emo. But finally, he got his break and is recorded by the top Hungarian pop singer, Paul Kalmar, and many others. The rest is history.
Lowest level of society till the top. Everyone loved that song. Everyone was singing it. The radio played it in the 30s, almost every day, everywhere where we went. There was no one social gathering, and the Gloomy Sunday was not a song.
Gloomy Sunday resonated all around the world. People in England, Germany, France, America, they were all singing it.
You will forget all your pain, and you will be just sad, very sad. But it's a beautiful sadness, and you can cry, and those tears will clear your mind. It's beautiful. I love that.
Cherish's dream of becoming famous had finally come true, and perhaps now he could win back his girlfriend's love. But that's when it started to happen.
People started committing suicide.
There's the story of a Hungarian shoemaker who left a note at the scene of his suicide, quoting some of the Gloomy Sunday lyrics.
In Vienna, a teenage girl drowned herself by clutching a piece of the song's sheet music.
One man shot himself after telling relatives he couldn't get that song out of his head.
A woman in London overdosed listening to a record of the songs keep over and over and over and over.
A young shopkeeper in Berlin hung herself in her apartment, the sheet music to Gloomy Sunday in her bedroom.
We don't even know the exact number because not everyone was discovered.
At least 19 suicides have been linked to the song, although many claim hundreds. We'll never know. Others say the Great Depression had a role in the deaths as well. Soon, the song became widely known as the Hungarian Suicide Song and was banned on BBC Radio. When asked about his infamous song, Sherish said,
I stand in the midst of this deadly success as an accused man. This fatal fame hurts me. I cried all my disappointments of my heart into this song, and it seems that others with feelings like mine have found their own hurts in it.
So the story goes, Sherish tried finding his ex-lover who had inspired him to write Gloomy Sunday. But to his horror, she too had taken her own life with poison.
And she had the music Gloomy Sunday with her. Basically, he, the composer, says that I am ready to die for you because I love you so much. Even if you don't love me, I have to tell you that I love you more than you can imagine because I am ready to die for you. And I think the girl killed herself. She demonstrated that she is the same as he stated in the text. It's a very, very good Shakespearean topic.
Many years later, after World War II and disappearing from the spotlight, a heartbroken Sherish finally surrendered to the curse of his song. As proclaimed in the climax,
my heart and I have decided to end it all. He jumped out of his window of his apartment, but he survived. But while recovering in the hospital, he choked himself to death.
Was that really necessary?
Why do you think did he have a choice? If he wrote that song, this was the only way how he could demonstrate that he was serious. He wouldn't be faithful to himself if he wouldn't have done that. He needed to do that. And he knew that, and he did.
Sherish may now be dead, but his song's haunting legacy lives on. Gloomy Sunday has been recorded over 80 times, covered by Billie Holiday to Elvis Costello to Bjork.
For in death I'm caressing you.
With the last breath of my heart I'll be blessing you.
Gloomy Sunday.
Although they've tacked on an extra verse to make the song PG. Apparently, the death mentioned in its lyrics was just a dream.
I was only dreaming.
Oh no, it's a cheating. You can't say after Romeo and Juliet, oh sorry, I was just kidding. Wait a second, you were not kidding. It's part of the human life. You can't have everything happy and he should come back and just tear those pages to pieces.
What about you? I mean, you're a Hungarian musician. What does this song mean for you?
So what it meant for me, something beautiful. This is that came to my mind, not the sadness, not the drama, but beautiful, beautifully sad. If I would have the chance to die, I would do that. Commit suicide with this song, put it on. And yeah, I just haven't decided which day, not yet.
Thanks so much to Laszlo Marozi for sharing that story. It was produced by our own David Kim. Now on Snap Judgment, the Blackout episode returns. Someone's goose is about to be cooked. Don't go anywhere. Snap Judgment.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to The Snap from PRX and NPR. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're calling this episode Blackout, because into every life a little darkness must fall. Now, our next story is born of the fevered imagination of writer Alyssa Nutting. It's performed by our very own Joyce Lee. Parents of small children should know that it does include some fantastical graphical imagery, and the little ones might not appreciate it.
I am boiling inside a kettle with five other people. Our limbs are bound and our intestines and mouths are stuffed with herbs and garlic, but we can still speak. We smell great despite the pain. The guy next to me resembles Elvis because of his fluffy, vaguely pubic black hairdo. It may be the humidity. Across the kettle, a man is trying to cry, but his tears keep mixing in with his sweat, and instead of looking sad, he just seems extra warm. For a moment, I have the romantic thought that maybe we are all actually boiling in tears, hundreds and thousands of them, the sweetest true tears of infants and children instead of a yellowy, thickish chicken broth. I'm the only woman in this kettle, which strikes me as odd. I'm voluptuous and curvy. I can understand why someone would want to gobble me up. The men do not look so delicious. One, a very old man across the kettle from me, keeps drifting in and out of a semi-conscious state. His head droops down towards the broth, and then suddenly, just as the tip of his nose touches one of the surface bubbles, he snaps upright and utters a name.
Stanley!
That's the first one. The second, David. We think he's saying the names of his children. We even continue to humor ourselves as he gets to the 15th. Perhaps he's moved on to grandchildren. But as he yells his 40th name, it's clear that he's not poignant. He's just nuts. He isn't crazy, the crying man sobs. These are the last few moments of our lives. Shouldn't we all be calling out the names of everyone we ever met, ever known, ever loved? Uh-huh, agrees Elvis. But the man to Elvis's left is not as fond of this idea. A series of teardrop tattoos on his upper cheek indicate victories in multiple prison kills. Ironically, he is tied up right next to the crying man.
I like quiet,
the tattoo man says. The man directly next to me on the right, he isn't really my type. His features are youthful and feminine in a way that makes him resemble a boyish Peter Pan. But he's smiling at me through the spices and trimmings shoved into his mouth, undeterred by them as he manages a nice, soft look. Since we're about to be eaten, I lower my standards and choose to be bold. I love you, I say. It's coming from a good pretend place. I just want to pack as much into these last few moments as I can. Yet when I watch the impact my words have on his face, the effect is very real. Maybe, I figure, since we are all cooking towards the finish line, things are kind of fast-forwarding. Maybe what I just said could actually be true. And then it is. Seconds pass. And love for him grows suddenly like ice crystals or sea monkeys all over my body. We stare at one another and he scoots towards me as much as our fetters will allow, enough that our fingertips can touch. I love you too, he says. If we weren't tied up, I'd give you the softest kiss you'd ever felt in your life right on your steamy lips. From the corner of my eye, I notice the tattoo man, who up until this point hasn't been very chatty, is suddenly showing me variegated upper teeth, his lips pulled back wide in order to verbalize the list of things he would do to me if we were not tied up. And they are not romantic or legal. You're a monster, my lover says to him. The rest of us shouldn't have to boil in your juices. Uh-huh, agrees Elvis. We're dying just like this criminal, weeps the crying man. It isn't fair. Suddenly, the old man raises his head. A drop of yellow broth falls from his chin.
Amanda,
he rasps. Then his eyes roll back and his head falls down. I smile. That's my name. Glee fills me, though I don't know why he just spoke my name. Amanda, my lover whispers my name into the hot mist. What if it's some kind of death list, the crying man snivels. What if that old cadre has been here for ages, been in pots with hundreds of people who've all been eaten? but he always gets left behind because he's so old. It would drive a person crazy. It might make him repeat over and over again the names of people he had to watch die in a half-hearted attempt to bring them back. After pondering this, the crying man lets out a long, shrill sob that is chirp-like. It reminds me of a parakeet I had when I was young. I try to remember its name.
Dad,
the old man says. That's my name, my lover laughs, bouncing a little in the water. He just said our names back to back. It's like our love planted them in his head. The tattooed man makes a gagging noise. For fun, I ask everyone to please mouth his name, just to see if the old man will say it next. I encourage them to hurry up and do it while the old man's head is flaccid under the layer of broth. Hector, whispers the crying man. Sam, sings Elvis.
Off,
mutters the tattooed man. Dan and I watch the old man with anticipation. Finally, his aged face surfaces, and he gums the taste of the broth droplets on his cheeks before saying,
Lancelot.
See, my lover coos, our names before, it was magic. I want this moment to stay. I want it to multiply on and on with the unnatural growth of things just before death, speeding off the pure fat of life's last moments. I want the feeling of our brushing fingertips to breed like cancerous cells. When the steel door opens, even the old man sits up and blinks his wet lashes. A chef walks in, sharpening a long knife against a stone.
Who first?
He barks.
All right, then.
The chef points his knife at me and moves it a little like he's writing his name in the air.
I'll take you since you're the meatiest.
I give my lover a farewell glance, but suddenly his screams fill the room. No! He cries, thrashing madly and fish-like. Take me in her place, please. I beg you, make her the very last one.
Okay.
Agrees the chef. But first he twirls his knife at me a little more like he's casting a spell just so I know who's in charge. Two men, wearing long oven gloves, come over and cut my lover's rope. He stretches his lips out to kiss me, but is too soon pulled away and carried from the room like a ladder. One man at his shoulders, one man at his feet. Please, he begs, one kiss. But the two men aren't as permissive as the cook. They possibly do not speak English or any language. That was so beautiful, sobs the crying man. Such love. Despite my grief, I try to live in the moment. Do you sing? I ask Elvis Sam. There's a moon out tonight, he croons. The garlic cloves really muffle his vibrato. When the chef and his goons re-enter, the tattooed man speaks up.
Take me,
he says.
I hate these people.
So they take him. As he's pulled from the water, we see that he also has a tattoo on his arm that reads, Mother. This makes crying Hector cry even harder. I should have called my mother more, he laments. Told her I loved her and appreciated her cooking. This one's for the mother, says Elvis Sam. He began singing, You are the sunshine of my life. Crying Hector's sobs are uncontrollable. His emotion touches me. I watch the ripples in the broth move from his torso over to mine, lapping at my stomach like a soft current. It will be okay, Hector. I want to extend my foot across our little bouillon pond and wipe his tears with my brothy toes, but my legs are bound together at the ankles. When the door opens, four men, increasingly sour from the first to the fourth, enter with the chef.
I need two,
he orders. The men grab Elvis Sam and crying Hector, who continue singing and weeping respectively as they are carried away. Alone with the old man, it is very quiet, and I realize how loud the boiling noises have become. He lifts his head and says,
Heidi.
I knew a Heidi once. From ballet class in high school, I imagine being taken from the kettle and laid onto a silver platter next to a giant cake, and on top of that cake is Heidi, posed in graceful pirouette. When they lift the old man from the broth, I'm surprised to see that he's missing a leg. I wonder if he arrived with it missing or if they'd eaten his leg and then putting him back. With all the others gone, the boiling bubbles feel far more scalding than before. I'm bad at science and uncertain if before we had all somehow shared the heat, but now I alone bear its brunt. It seems so. I miss my lover, and my willingness to suffer perhaps makes the broth feel hotter as well. As the footsteps come, I wonder if there will be anything after death. Perhaps Dan will be waiting for me on the other side, and our new and budding love will be allowed to blossom from the beyond. Then, although morbid, I try to prepare myself for what it will feel like when they cut me up. There are worse ways to die, I tell myself, than being boiled and then sliced with a knife. But it takes me a while to think of one. Finally, I imagine being carried out the door to a table where all of my five kettle mates are waiting, forks and knives in their hands, skin still pink from the boiling broth. I imagine Dan saying he has dibs on my heart, and the others laughing, and Elvis singing good night, sweetheart, as my carving starts, and I lose consciousness to the sounds of battling forks and knives. This daydream dampens the horror of my fate, like a bowl placed over a candle. You can bear anything, I tell myself, if you know you're not alone. And the cold air stings my cooked skin as the men lift me in their arms. Their fingers are strong with knowledge. I'm only going where the others have already been.
Thanks so much to Alyssa Nutting and to Joyce Lee for her performance. No Joyce Lees were harmed in the making of this piece. The story comes to us from Alyssa Nutting's book, Unclean Jobs for Women and Girls. Learn more at alyssanutting.com, and we'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Eliza Smith and Mark Ristich, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. It's that time. But if you want more, we understand. Movies, pictures, stuff await your pleasure right now at snapjudgment.org. Friends, snap on the Facebook right now. See what everyone looks like. They look good. They look good. Hit snap on Twitter. The Blackout episode was produced by the team that never blacks out, even though I give them ample cause. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He runs down the beats, Pat Macedi Miller. Anna Sussman never runs. Julia DeWitt runs a 4-minute mile. Joe Rosenberg runs up the bill. Nancy Lopez runs away. And David Kim is running that game, you know. Jasmine Aguilera runs her mouth. I kid, I'm kidding. Our Snap production crew runs around. Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Aurora Soria. And of course, Will Urbina walks. Did you ever dip your hand in a bucket of cold water, then touch the Corporation for Public Broadcasting right behind the ear? I wouldn't advise it. Wouldn't advise it at all, but much love to the CPB. You ever find PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, sleeping, and then put their hand in a bucket of warm water? Hilarious what happens next to PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago can't be bought, only influenced. And you may have already ascertained that This is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could join the away party with Captain Kirk, set phasers to stun, only to realize that you're wearing a red uniform and you're going to get whacked for sure. Even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.